Welcome, dear listener. Hello, how are you? How have you been? I hope you're healthy. I hope you're well. And maybe you're wearing a rag on your face. Take it off. Settle down. You're at home, probably. It's the Podcast with a K, with me, Christian Corley. And this is James McLean. James, how are you?
That's an interesting question. I was saying to someone the other day that it's a question we should know. We need to remove out of the lexicon.
Okay.
It's one that, well, I mean, 2020, I don't want to sound like, you know, playing sort of the buzzwords and the tunes of everything we see on Twitter, but it's not been a great year for many people. And, you know, how are you just feels like a really out of touch way of meeting people. And I think the way that we need to be changing that is we just say, look at each other and we just go, doom. The other person goes, doom. And we both understand where we are because that is really where we are.
Okay. Were you saying do or doom?
Doom. Doom.
We're doomed. Doom.
Yes.
Right, okay.
Just doom to you, Gov.
Doom to you.
It's just an acknowledgement because, I mean, we know that the place, everything's bad. So asking how are you is almost sort of almost like an almost an insult.
Well, perhaps.
Like, well, you know, everything's bad. How do you think I feel? Are you asking me that I should be somehow better? Are you saying that I'm in a worse state than I should be? You know, what are you inferring here? But if you just sort of say doom, and the other person goes, looking around, yeah, doom.
Could we maybe formalise
it? With some honesty.
How do you doom?
Well, yeah, I mean, that starts to become a bit sort of punny. I like something like doom to you, Gov, because it sort of is a bit of a callback to a dead British culture, which is often what our podcasts talk about. So, doom to you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, we trust that you are listening to this podcast in the usual way, and you're probably wondering where we've been. Well, we're basically, like everyone else, we haven't been anywhere, and that's why we haven't recorded any podcasts. I have some children which kind of made it impossible for me to record podcasts, but they're back at school for the time being, and obviously James has a vast army of Dalek mutants that he needs to keep charge of, so they've been taken up all of his
it's a pain, isn't it? It's a time where we have loads of time and yet somehow we don't. Yeah. And it's a fascinating time because, like you were intimating in the beginning, people listening to this now might be listening to it in a different way. They might have been listening to it on their way to work and now they are at work by their coffee table.
Yeah. You know?
Or they may be listening to it having found that place under the bed where they can weep without the children noticing, and they might just have the podcast in the, you know, and headphones in their ears as they cry.
Or, you know, 10 years in the future, changed. 10 years in the future, they could be listening to it in a split second, having had it downloaded via a implant.
Or it could be found by the remnants of man searching through the rubble on some aged sound device, which they press with a sort of primite-like finger.
Like the first
10 years, obviously we'll have mutated in 10 years, but again, all the shows we talk about tend to have that sort of logic.
Like the first part of Trial of a Time Lord.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Just like that. Because that was 10 years in the future.
Yeah, so anyway, we speaking of Trial of a Time Lord.
1997.
We are talking about the best worst episodes of Doctor Who. It seems somewhat prescient that we should have, certainly coincidental, that Trial of a Time Lord should have popped up, perhaps. So basically the idea is James's, so I'll let him explain it.
Well, my idea was, when we were just talking, saying, should we do a podcast? And someone said, yeah, all right. Like, what would we do it on? And I don't know. Right? And we do it on the 10 best worst episodes of Doctor Who. And maybe then at the beginning we can talk rubbish and hopefully be riffing in our head on ideas of what we could actually talk about.
Yeah,
and then by the time that... Yeah, it's exactly. It didn't happen. I have no idea what this is going to be. But I like the sound of it. It sounds buzzy. It sounds light. And I think in these days we need buzzy and light. You know, we don't need to be talking about, you know, controversial topics of timeless children or whatever. We just need to be looking at fluffy stuff that makes us all happy.
Yeah.
Silly stuff.
I'm going to throw this out open, commence this, because I have thought of one.
Yep.
And it is... It's perhaps not the best worst episode in the kind of so bad it's good sort of way, but this might re-spin the entire conversation as we progress through this discussion. it may not. But, you know, for many, many years, I absolutely hated Unearthly Child. I found it difficult to watch, difficult to get into. I mean, obviously, the grainy quality of the VHS and the broadcast versions that they used in 1993, I think, and the earlier version, which wasn't broadcast, the unbroadcast pilot. I just found it, compared to everything else that was on, and having a recent memory of Doctor Who with Sylvester McCoy, which was a very fast, pacey show, watching Unearthly Child the first time, which I suspect the first time I watched it all the way through and understood what was going on, was in 1993. I absolutely hated it. I thought it was terrible. I thought it was shoddy and ropey, and I could see all the camera jars and inadvertent zooms and fluffs, and I thought it was terrible. I really, really thought it was terrible. Now, obviously, many of those problems still exist, but I don't think it's terrible anymore. So I don't feel that it is the worst Doctor Who episode. What's this thing called again? The best worst episodes? Or yeah, so I don't think it's the worst thing, and it's clearly in many ways one of the best Doctor Who. So that, and I know that wasn't the initial conception of this, but that's kind of what I'm thinking at the moment.
But I mean, there is a lot of people who do sort of say, I mean, it's very popular to say, Unearthly Child, love the first episode, hate the next three.
Yes.
So in a sense, it is considered a bad episode.
I mean, story. I was in that group at one point. But I think as well, I don't know whether this is, we're going to end up going way off on the tangent on this, but the whole thing of the cave people, for want of a far better term, Tribe of Gum, and the acting perhaps in the portrayal of them isn't perhaps particularly good. But when you get to the point, and it's maybe a bit kind of cod, but then again you've got the whole sort of who's the audience, well, it's children mainly, and then you've got the whole thing, well, actually maybe the whole forgetting how to make fire thing as well, and then rediscovering fire, is kind of, that's quite important. And so there's quite a lot of important things going on in there, and there's quite a reasonable, for the time slot and the length and the depth of the show, quite a reasonable explanation of the hierarchy in those sorts of societies as well. So it does quite a lot really well.
It's annoying because I'd like to be in a position here to be in the traditional approach, which, and to create tension and thus drama for the listener to listen to us, to be able to disagree with you. But I totally agree with you on everything there. I remember when I first saw it, I was disappointed. And I loved the first episode. I think I loved the first episode. I saw it years ago, I think, when they were doing in the 80s, the sort of, yeah, that sort of recycling of key episodes. And yeah, I found the rest very boring. And then when I've got older, and I think, like you said, that's because used to a different pace.
Yeah.
At the time when I was seeing it, but when I got older and I rewatched it, I actually prefer the three episodes to the first one.
Yes.
Because for the same reasons, I think there's some really beautiful writing in there that is very sensitive about not making these, let's call them cavemen, stupid. It makes their culture, you could say that they are naive to certain sciences, but do you know what I mean? They're not just dumb animals or dumb idiots. There is, as you say, there's a culture there, there's hierarchies at play. You can see them working around that. You can see the logic in why they think and how they think and how that all integrates. It's really, really interesting. And then on top of that, you've got this, which is constantly forgotten in the show's mythology, this really fascinating setup of it being Barbara and Ian, specifically Ian, who really pulls the Doctor onto a different trajectory.
Yeah.
That prior to that, he's very, very not self-serving, but very protectionist of him and his granddaughter. And that shifts, and that whole thing is really interesting too. And then you've got the fact that they're in a position where you've got these two people totally out of time and space, and watching them adapt. And there's loads of great stuff going in on there. But at the same time, I can understand why people find it a bit slow and perhaps a bit uninteresting after the setup of the first episode. So I think it's a good example. It's an episode which I don't think you could say is perfect and is weak because people find it weak, and you can't ignore the fact if people generally don't like it, there's probably something wrong there. But at the same time, I think if you look at it, there is lots of that stuff there to love.
Yeah. Got us off to so the good that's start, our podcast. Then, didn't it? Yeah. So, well, I mean, I have another idea. Do you want to take a turn?
No, go with yours. I'm happy to see what you say.
Well, we talked about this one a few times on the podcast in various ways, but I do feel more as though I've made my peace with Love and Monsters.
Okay, cool. 10 years. That's cool. Go on. I'm interested.
Well, you know, well, it was 2006, wasn't it? So, yeah, it's only taken me 14 years. I've probably made my peace about a couple of years ago. But and I think we talked about it. Did we do a commentary on Love and Monsters? I'm not sure, with Brian.
I think we did, yeah. I think I remember us doing the ending of it. Yeah, we did. Many years ago.
Yeah, and it is incredibly silly, and yes, it feels utterly pointless and trivial and disposable. But maybe, you know, Doctor Who doesn't need to be sort of like the urgent, big episode every time. It has to be like a patchwork of different textures, just like any piece of music has to be loud or quiet, or any conversation has to be fast and slow and have pauses and etc. So maybe that's not the problem with it. Maybe it was just because it was a completely different type of episode, and it isn't executed perhaps as well as people involved might have wanted it to be. The winner of the Blue Peter competition envisaged the Absorbloff to be as big as a house, and he's only as big as an extremely large Peter K. And but on the other hand, he's got such a lot of stuff going on, and he's got Mark Warren in it, and it's got Kamal Khajuri doing stuff without Rose and without the Doctor, and then you've got all that sort of like secondary cast, and you've got Peter K, and it's just, it has a kind of silly, cartoony charm to it, which it still feels utterly inconsequential. But I don't have deep dislike for it anymore. I would happily watch it if it were to come on.
That's interesting, because I mean, I was obviously, well, I'm not going to say I was on totally other end of the spectrum when I first watched it. I remember being immediately turned off by the opening. Opening segment with them running around with the old classic, seeing them backwards and forth down the same corridor, running left to right, and thinking, I'm not going to like this. This is annoying me already. And I still don't like that bit.
No.
It feels like it is the embodiment of everything that is Russell T. Davis. There is so much in there which speaks to who he is. I mean, there is, as you say, there's an element of silliness in there, perhaps a little over-the-top silliness, which he does do. There's some really nice character writing in there, as you say, between Jackie and Mark Warren's character, which I thought was really enjoyable. It was really nice to see Jackie having an opportunity to be fleshed out there.
Yeah.
I think in terms of the smart, deft use of the production to actually do a sort of like this sort of second unit thing and get an episode out without, you know, drop another episode into the run-up, into the lineup for the year, made out of, you know, bits and pieces, was a really quite interesting and innovative approach too.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I think there's some really beautiful stuff in there. I think there's stuff in there which, unfortunately, because there's a lot of comedy, and comedy is subjective, especially for Doctor Who fans. So I think the nature of comedy itself is an odd thing for Doctor Who, because there is a lot of comedy in Doctor Who, but at the same time, you know, it doesn't always appeal to everyone. I found Peter K great in it. I mean, yeah, the Absorbloff wasn't particularly mind-blowing in itself, but there were some moments in it which made me chuckle. I found, you know, Klom was actually a really good gag at the time.
Yeah,
it worked. I liked that sort of sparring. I didn't find the sexual, the sort of pansexual relationship at the end with the concrete block, it didn't bother me as much as it bothered other people. But I can understand why it bothered people. So for me, yeah, I've always quite enjoyed it. I don't think it's a perfect episode, so I think in a sense it does fit well into this group. It is arguably a worst episode. Again, if we're using it as a measurement, if the metric is how many people like a story or not, roughly speaking, it's not one that you would say people tend to say they like. So yeah, maybe it is one. Actually, if you watch it, there's enough stuff in there to make it interesting, because the group is actually kind of sympathetic as well. They're quite well characterised.
Mm. And, well cast as well. You know, Shirley Henderson, Simon Greenall, Moya Brady, Catherine Drysdale. And there's even Bella Enberg in the market as well, isn't there? So
it's I think there's stuff in there that's you can enjoy, even if there are bits in there which might irritate you for various reasons. No, that's a good choice. I like the way it's at pretty much the other end of the spectrum as well from where we were. I mean, one I'm going to advocate, which to me shouldn't have to be on this list because I don't think it's the worst in any way, but what it falls into the criteria that you started of ones that I didn't particularly like at the time, and I like now, and also the criteria that a lot of people don't like it. I will always, and I know I've done a podcast on this with Brian, Delta and the Bannermen will always sit in there for me, which I think is such an innovative and beautiful little tale. But at the time, I did not like it. As a kid, teen, whatever I was, I just didn't like it. It was too silly. The Bannermen have no real threat in it, which they don't. Gavrock played is a very hammy sort of characterization. It's not really down to the acting, but things like having him eating raw meat just looks silly. It doesn't look threatening. And yet somehow when I watched it when I was older, I thought, this is actually a really nice tale. You've got all this lovely outside broadcasting. You've got some really gentle beats in there with the Doctor as well. And what was her name? The one that wasn't a companion. Name's only gone for me. It's sort of obvious. Ray. You know, some nice little moments there, some nice little moments of the dance, you know, the whole chalets and, you know, I don't know. There's something that really works there. And if you get past the things which annoy you, which was a kid for me with things like the bus, you know, and this you know, very flippant time travel to the past notion, which, and the toll gate, which again seemed ridiculous to me at the time. And as I say, the Bannermen not being very effective and maybe the Shimmerin also being a bit creepy in that relationship going on there, and poor Ray at the end who just has to head off on her bike. There's still some really nice stuff in there. I think sometimes it's about taking it for what it is, and then you can find a lot in there. There's a lot, it's very new Who, there's a lot of different set pieces going on, isn't there? There's a bit, almost feels like, you know, where Robert Holmes had an impact in Doctor Who in some respects. Was in the way that he sort of laid the ground for these sort of small character pieces in stories. So you have the two American agents in there, which have very little relevance to the story.
Yeah.
But it's still just quite nice. The bees are actually quite interesting as well. And like I say, the ambience in there is good. And there are some good moments. You know, there's some quite dark moments as well. You know, the destruction of the bus and its passengers. Ken Dodd's irritating character being brutally shot. You know, it's not all floaty, you know, fluffy stuff. There's some quite dark things in there. But I think it's a good example of Harding, even though he's not as interesting as he'll become. I think Delta and the Bannermen for me.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good suggestion. It's interesting how many or how much of the Seventh Doctor era actually feels quite close to the Russell T Davies era, doesn't it? Tenth Doctors, despite that kind of 16-year period, there were similarities at the time which seemed quite recognisable. But now with the extension of time away from that, well away, you know, it's 15 years since Rose, so it's nearly as far away next year. Oh my God! Next year, it's 16 years since Rose, which is the same distance of time between Rose and Survival, and there's obviously clearly differences between them, but there's also, you know, those last two series in particular, probably the last three series, but certainly the last two series of the 1980s, a very fast pace.
Well, Survival and Rose, as we've said before many years ago, tonality wise got quite a lot of similarities as well. You feel like if we ignore the McGann film, which is a sad thing, and maybe one that should be on this list thinking about it, but there is a tonality there between the two.
Yeah. Well, all right then, Paul McGann film. Are we doing best worst or worst best? I forget. But
it's subjective, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The thing about the Paul McGann film is that it's the only Doctor Who in that sandwich, isn't it? that you can watch. I mean, you could have watched Death Comes to Time or Real Time if you were particularly bored mm-hmm. or really hated yourself and just wanted to put yourself through the slog of watching some figures move very slowly on a 56K dial-up modem. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, feel yourself extremely fortunate. Consider yourself fortunate. But the TV movie is just such a beautiful production that it also isn't particularly very good in many ways and is really good in many other ways. And, you know, it went out on the bank holiday Monday in the UK and it took in like 9 million viewers, which Doctor Who would love 9 million viewers these days. And it wasn't a time when Doctor Who had any interest whatsoever. I'm pretty sure there was football on the other side. So a lot of people stayed. In fact, I'm certain there was football. In fact, I had to take a night off work behind a bar in order to stay home and watch Doctor Who. And that was a Monday. And all right, it was a bank holiday, so it would have been busy. There was definitely football on that night. And it still pulled in 9 million viewers. So that's nothing to be sniffed at. Yet there's obviously all these bumpy things about it. And I think it's possibly the... Maybe one of the things that people dislike about it is not so much a specific thing, but that it is a big prime time moment that changes things in Doctor Who in a way that they probably hadn't been changed in such one way, in one episode. You know, previously changes have been done gradually over time, say things introduced in the War Games or in the early Pertwee era or in Deadly Assassin or Ark of Infinity, and these very time lordy things, of course. And when you get to the TV movie, you've got that amount of new developments / changes to what we know about Doctor Who all in one, and then a few others. And I think that maybe is what makes it quite a jarring experience for some Doctor Who fans. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that, and I think there's obviously the Americanization as well.
Yeah. Which,
Canadianization, if you want, but there's that. I think a lot of people found, I remember people talking at the time a lot about the motorcycle chase
mm-hmm.
being just something that Americans do that we don't tend to do, and feeling that was inappropriate for the framework of Doctor Who. Which
obviously is nonsense.
Which, yes, it's very, that is almost like a oxymoron, that our idea that there should be a framework for Doctor Who. Yeah, I agree. I remember watching it. I remember liking the first 25 minutes and then becoming slightly less enfranchised almost immediately after the Who Am I bit. It sort of becomes a little more generic. I don't think there's any denial of that.
I mean,
it got a lot of viewers. I mean, whether it's got a lot of appreciation. I mean, I think you're right. I think there's a lot when you watch it and you take it for what it is. There's a lot of things to appreciate. I think that it's a very, it's got a nice tonality to it in terms of its aesthetic and its use of colours, which of course is very blue for the 90s, following on from the X-Files. There's a lot of blue tones in there. But it feels very, and I think after Doctor Who being on such a budget, it was quite beautiful to see Sylvester McCoy as being the crossover in a situation, sitting almost, you know, eating his jelly babies in a lap of luxury. It was almost like a sort of meta commentary on the fact that here he was finally with a budget, able to just sit back and enjoy this opulence of this almost like throne room or console room. And that was really interesting to see as a fan, to see that sort of what Doctor Who could be like if it was done with money. And there's some nice lines in it as well, isn't there? I mean, it's not all bad. There's stuff in there, like I say, that's a very generic, and the use of time is a bit disappointing, you know, the reset button, which, interestingly, the book doesn't do, as I recall. The book does differently. Gary Russell book does the end differently, and I wonder whether there was changes between script and production.
I've never read it. I own it, but I never read it because I didn't assume.
I mean, the book has lots of New Adventures Virgin references in it as well. It references bits of New Adventures, which is kind of cheeky, but as I say, I'm pretty sure it's Gary Russell who wrote it, and it doesn't surprise me. But yeah, in the end, I think they make it. I'm trying to think, because they get they get killed, don't they, in the film version?
Yeah.
I think in the book they're not. I think that the timey-wimey reset isn't quite as rigid. And I can't remember the details. And maybe if anyone is listening to this, if any of you out there now, 10 years' time or whatever, are listening to this, if you could let us know whether you've read the book and what actually the end of the book was like, because I remember it being different. But I can't remember quite how different it was.
It's probably a good chance you'll be able to finish it, a second read of the book, in 10 years. So.
in 10 minutes, it was fairly... fairly quick speed read. I'm not saying it was one of Gary's in-depth books, but there was a nice smattering of interesting stuff in there that wasn't in the film. And I'm trying to remember what they were. I'm wondering if someone didn't survive. I can't remember. Anyway, point being, yeah, I think there's stuff in there which isn't good. I mean, I don't think Eric Roberts is that bad as well, to be honest.
I
mean,
like
again,
Eric Roberts.
We're, as you said, quite succinctly, we're in an era where we weren't used to change or seeing differences to former. Now, we've had John Sim. We've had Derek Jacobi. We've had Missy. You know, we've had very different archetypes of master, different to the archetype of the bearded master.
Yeah.
And Eric Roberts was unfortunately the first person to be that, you know, against that, and also not having a British accent. But if you actually look at how he does the role, you know, the master's there. I think the master's there. Yeah, I do wonder whether time is kinder to it. Do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think as well, maybe there's another side to this as well. Maybe it's become more accepted because we watch more American TV now than we used to, I think. Or certainly more American drama now than we used to. So in terms of, it feels more like Doctor Who because it doesn't feel like you've gone from quote unquote shaky walls and sticky tape to like lavish production values, because you watch it now in the context of the fact that we watch a lot more American drama as opposed to those days when it was mostly American sitcoms that we might watch at like 5 o'clock on ITV or whatever. I think it feels more like it doesn't feel jarring. It doesn't have that kind of alien feel to it that it maybe had in 1996. A lot of people said, oh well, this isn't Doctor Who because it hasn't been filmed in an overlit BBC television centre studio, you know. So I think maybe, as you say, it does have the benefit of time on its side.
The use of the cloaking device, the use yes. of, and of course the kiss as well was
the
a big
kiss,
thing.
Yes, the kiss was a huge thing. That I remember old Reckart Doctor Who almost melted Usenet.
When that happened,
like, Google it, everyone. Just Google it if you don't know what I'm talking about.
How are we in a techno-utopian period when we had things like that and real media? You know, stuff which would really put you off the idea the internet could ever do anything good. Yeah. Little did we know what good it would bring. Yeah, but I mean, I think the British standards changed. I mean, like, Doctor Who has had car chases. Okay, it's had TARDIS chases. Mm. It's had, you know, motorbikes in ways that, I'm sure if they had the money, the budget for the film, they would have quite happily had a TARDIS going, or the imagination maybe, had the TARDIS shooting down a motorway in that as well. You know, the way our television has shifted as well, and the way our action has become perhaps a little more normalised. You know, Spooks as well, you know, being a good example. I don't know. I think you're right. I think how we watch television, how we see material has changed. I think the TV movie...
Yeah. Well, of course, I mean, there's probably a different podcast in this, but a lot of this is to do with how technology has shrunk cameras, improved lenses, and given us the affordable special effects as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's kind of sad in the sense that that movie is probably one that still always remains almost like opted out of transmissions or catalogues. You know, it's still the black sheep of the... Of the Doctor Who catalogue, really, sadly, which it probably doesn't deserve. And Paul McGann does a really nice performance, and yeah. I think Sylvester's is a very understated Sylvester performance, which I was always a bit disappointed at, because he's a little different to obviously how he is in Survival, for instance.
Well, McGann is. I mean, it's. I mean, we can only contextualise this by the fact that there was only one episode featuring him for 15 years or whatever it was. 20 years? Mm-hmm. Close to 20 years, obviously. But it's basically a character-defining performance in the space of about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, you could easily say, you got a good enough feeling of what the Doctor was, and certainly good enough that, again, I think it was Gary Russell who wrote the comic strips for the Radio Times at the same time that came out with, and certainly the books and the radio and the big finished dramas as well. There was enough there that to give you a feeling before you even get to Day of the Doctor what the Paul McGann Doctor was about, and it was quite, you know, this slightly romanticised characterization, which wasn't just simply down to the wig, it was down to the way he performed it. Very gentle, very charming, very tactile Doctor. So yeah, I think there's a lot there to be considering. That's good. I think we spent a lot of time on that one.
Yeah. I was thinking there's a few kind of episodes for our fifth selection, and from the sort of the late Tom Baker era, and there's one that gets a lot of stick which shouldn't, and I think we've talked about it before, and that's Underworld.
Okay, yes.
Because, yes, it does have some quite boring pieces and it is too long, but I think it succeeds in the technical execution of the you know, that whole CSO section. I think it's superbly done, given it's 1978 and it's the BBC in a studio at Television Centre, as opposed to something being done over at Pinewood or the other studios in the UK at the time. It's immensely accomplished, basically. They've been very ambitious, and I feel that they've got away with it. In terms of the story itself and some of the dialogue, not so much, but from a technical standpoint, it looks really good, I feel.
That's an interesting one, because it's not one that I've only ever watched once and never really wanted to go back to it. So it's one that I would probably go, I perhaps need to watch it again.
I mean, it does have a lot of familiar elements in it, but that whole technical side to it, it worked for me.
Well, I think that's really the sort of essential element of what I think is good in this list. You know, you can sort of advocate, which are generally considered to be fairly rubbish. I mean, we're not going to go into much because we've talked about it before, which I've always enjoyed, and I'm not sure that's just pure nostalgia on my part, but I don't think it is Deaths of the Daleks, which again is a story which tends to be lambasted for being a bit bland in every guide that you'll read. It's got a really fast pace compared to most 70s story. It feels like an 80s story, late 80s. It feels like a Sylvester story, to be honest, in terms of that pacing. So it's very well structured. It's got some very traditional turncoat characters like Galloway, but they're well played, well acted. It looks great. The Roots, the Exelons, the Daleks all look, you know, they look nice, and it's well filmed. It's got a lot of variety in it. It's just a good standalone story. I think it's a really good... And it tries to do something different with the Daleks. Maybe it doesn't do enough, but I think it's just a very, very nice, neat little package.
There is a generic element to it, certainly. And I think maybe if you've read if you've read Dalek comic strips, then it perhaps doesn't feel all that maybe original in television terms. But I like it. I like the bullets that the Daleks, the little bullet shooters, or guns, as we call them on Earth, that the Daleks have. There's ambition with the CSO there as well, which I quite like.
Yeah, it's really well mapped, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Exelon City looks great throughout it.
It does, yes.
I like the beginning. I like the TARDIS crash landing. I think it's kind of cool and a great setup. There's a lot of mystery. The world unfolds with the characters, which is always nice. Mm-hmm. So you know nothing about this planet until they do. As I say, I think what Galloway's good. The rest are fairly bland in terms of characters. But the Exelons look good. I think they have nice design as well with their reflective elements, which isn't always perfect, but, you know, it's a good... And I think that the whole precursor to Sutex maze. You have the maze of the Exelon City, which is an interesting fourth part. So it makes it, it feels like it unfolds all the way through, where instead of just going backwards and forth, as a lot of the stories do at that time between two spaces, it unfolds well. And I think it should be, I think it should get better, have better value than it does with Doctor Who circles.
Get more love.
Yes. Get more of the love.
I don't think I said love. Right, let's stop being northern for a minute. Well, I can't do that, but anyway. So we've thrown at you a selection of the best, worst, / worst, best episodes of Doctor Who. So, obviously, we would like to hear your own thoughts on this. So throw them beneath, throw it back at us beneath on Facebook or on castorbus.co.uk. And before I go, James, I didn't tell you about this either beforehand, and I probably should have mentioned it. We've got a little new website in development at Castorbus called Sol3, which is based on a thing that existed in an old fanzine that Gareth Cavanagh was involved in, Black Scrolls. So it's basically spoof stuff. There's a little world being created of our world being reflected in the kind of unified fictional world of anyone who grew up in the 70s and 80s, basically. That's kind of the thing. So there's elements of Doctor Who, heavily elements of Doctor Who, a few other TV shows, and it'll be going live in the next month or so. There's a backlog of stuff being created, and there's a Twitter account called Sol3 News that you can follow as well for more quote-unquote hilarity. So and it's on Facebook as well, so I'll put the links in the show notes for that, so you can just check it out. And please follow us to and like me. If you want more of it, if you want to get the latest post, then just click like on it, and I just need my cupboard. So that's that. We'll be recording some more podcasts for you soon, dear listener. Take care. Until next time, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Castorbus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCastorbus.com.